This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with artist and journalist Trevor Paglen about the surveillance state.
He takes up where Edward Snowden left off in blowing the whistle on the massive police state that's been constructed all around us.
We'll speak with Natasha Bonin, the newly elected president of the National Lawyers Guild.
We'll talk about the origins of the Guild, its current work, particularly with Black Lives Matter and international solidarity, especially Puerto Rico.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We recently spoke with the director of the Library Freedom Project about a New Hampshire library standing its ground by using the Tor browser to protect the anonymity of its patrons from the Department of Homeland Security surveillance. A victory, yes, but also another stark reminder of what society now confronts while under a total surveillance state. It's mostly unseen. The data passing through the air, cables behind walls, in the ground and underwater is all out there strangling us, spying on us. Our guest, Trevor Paglen, brings these images and concepts into the public consciousness in art showings throughout the world. Trevor Paglen has photographed and written about drones, military black sites, and satellites. He's an artist, image maker, journalist, and engineer. He holds a PhD in experimental geography and has contributed research and cinematography to the Academy Award-winning film Citizen Four. He joins us today to talk about his work.
Trevor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, in an article called Turnkey Terrorism, you've written that fear causes society to collapse on itself. What do you mean by that?
I guess what I meant by that in that article is that fear can be a very powerful tool of political control, and that when we make decisions based on fear, we tend to make very bad decisions, decisions that can have, that might feel good in the short term, but that have long-term consequences that we tend to ignore in the short term because we're, you know, captivated by that fear. Fear is a very powerful emotion, and that's why you see so many people in the political arena trying to use it as a tactic to accrue power.
I remember when Richard Nixon retired and a reporter asked him what the secret was of his political success, and he said, it was fear, and they don't teach you that in the Boy Scouts.
Yeah, absolutely. But you, that's absolutely true.
You write about the impending disasters, both ecologically with severe climate change, and also economically, which you call the Great Divergence. So we have the disasters of terror, the tools that have been brought to fight what they call terror, and then this disaster of nature and the economic situation that's unfolding. You talk about various tools of the surveillance state being used here domestically. And that we're really living already in that kind of a situation. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that article was written in the context of the Snowden revelations when everybody, you know, millions of people around the world were learning about the existence of a state-sponsored surveillance program, the likes of which humankind had never seen before. In other words, even people I know within the telecommunications industry, to the very last person I've ever talked to, was utterly shocked by this scale of the NSA's surveillance programs. And so that was the context of it. And I was trying to think through, why is surveillance bad? I mean, and there's surveillance. You can make arguments about whether it defends, you know, invades privacy and what the cumulative effect of that sort of thing is. But for me, the way that I was trying to frame that question was saying, you know, this is bad because what you've basically done by the creation of this surveillance state is you have created a very powerful tool that could be put to use could be put to use in a totalitarian society very easily, right? And so the question is not whether or not you trust Barack Obama to have these powers available to him. The question is, do you trust this capability to a J. Edgar Hoover or to a Caligula, for example? And I was thinking about what the immediate and looking at a decade or more out in terms of the greatest challenges that are going to be confronting American society. And, of course, there are many, but two that I think are extremely important. On one hand is environmental degradation. There's going to be huge, refugees, migration. There's going to be a whole host of problems and kind of unrest produced as a result of intensifying climate change, on one hand. And on the other hand, over the last several decades, since the 1970s, we've seen a kind of extreme bifurcation of wealth distribution in the country, and that doesn't seem to be going anywhere anytime soon. So we are really creating a two-tiered class in the country where you have a kind of 1% and everybody else. And that, too, is going to be a great source of instability looking towards the future. And when I look at this future landscape of, on one hand, extreme inequality and extreme disruptions through environmental disasters, and I think about, well, what tools will the state have available to it in order to try to mitigate the effects of those two trends? And mass surveillance could be an incredibly powerful tool to mitigate against them, to contain people. And it would be a very coercive tool. But this is exactly the kind of thing that you see in societies like Egypt, and this is exactly the kind of thing that we saw, for example, in the former East Germany. And I don't think that is a society that anybody wants to live in. But the fact that you've built this mass surveillance system strongly encourages people to use it in the future, and not in ways that would be much more objectionable than they may even be using it in the present.
Trevor, speaking of the surveillance state, can you tell us what you've learned specifically about the vulnerability of our undersea telecommunication cables?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the background to this is that I have been long-time friends with Laura Poitras, who's the director of Citizen 4, the documentary about Edward Snowden. She was also one of the first people that Edward Snowden went to. And what we had a number of long conversations about, you were learning a tremendous amount about what the infrastructures of mass surveillance look like, how they operate. These are highly technical things. And these are infrastructures that we actually don't really experience viscerally in our everyday life. In other words, in our everyday language, we use words like the cloud or cyberspace to talk about the internet. But these are quite literally mystifying metaphors. They make it seem as if the internet is everywhere and nowhere at the same time. But these are not really the metaphors that the NSA uses to talk about the internet. And for the NSA, the internet is an exquisitely material thing. It's cables, routers, switches. It's a very technical understanding and a very material understanding of how the internet works. And, of course, they have to have that understanding because they want to be able to cap it. They want to be able to see everything that's moving across the internet and track it and use it as a weapon even. And so that's how I started thinking about infrastructure, of mass surveillance in the first place. And then the other part of it was that, Snowden himself, as well as William Binney, another NSA whistleblower, were really harping a lot on cables, cable landing stations. And I'd never heard of what a landing station was, or was only vaguely aware of what a transcontinental fiber optic cable was in the first place. And one of the ways in which the internet works is that, the vast majority of global communication travels over fiber optic cables. Those cables connect all of the continents to one another. So, for example, in the U.S. and Europe, quite literally, the communication between those two continents is made by underwater fiber optic cables. So there's dozens of these things. And, same U.S., South America, U.S., and Asia, all connected by cables. And these cables are not evenly distributed around the world. In other words, They all cables come on shore at very specific places. On the west coast of the United States, there's about 7 of them. And on the east coast, you know, there's about 6 of them. And so you have places like, for example, one in Long Island, one in Miami, where many, many of these cables come to the same place. They all kind of come to the same landing station or kind of the same town, the same beach. And these are what the NSA calls choke points. So they're places where a huge amount of global telecommunications moves through one place in the world. And these, of course, are very, very juicy targets for mass surveillance, because if you put a tap on that place in, for example, Miami, where all communications between Europe and South America are going to move through a place in Miami, then you can, you know, collect much of the traffic flowing over the internet in general. So in terms of vulnerabilities, that's a huge vulnerability of global telecommunication systems, is that they that there are nodes on those networks where huge amounts of information come together and can be exploited and are exploited. So that's one vulnerability of the system. There's other vulnerabilities as well, which is the fact that they are really just out there in the ocean, lying on the floor of the ocean in many cases. And this is something that the United States has been taking advantage of for decades. In the 1970s, they had a submarine called the USS Halibut that would go and land on cables. In this case, they were Russian telecommunications cables. And it would land on the cable underwater and install a tap on there. And the tap would record all the traffic. They'd go back and pick it up. Now, you don't have to do that anymore. You can do that digitally now. But, you know, as we speak, the Navy has a dedicated submarine called the USS Jimmy Carter, whose job it is specifically to do this. The USS Jimmy Carter was designed to tap underwater cables. And in the news over the last couple of days, we've heard something similar about the Russians. We've heard about the American military being concerned because they have detected Russian ships and presumably Russian submarines in the vicinity of other transoceanic cables. The Russians could be doing something like tapping them, much in the same way that the U.S. does. But the other thing is that when you especially look at deep sea cables, these things can fail. And you don't necessarily know why they failed. You know, there could be an earthquake that causes one to break. Any number of things can happen to them. One could imagine that a country would go and install, you know, explosive charges on them or something, then go away, and then years later, the cable fails. It would be very, very hard to attribute whether there was an attack against that cable at all, and if there was, who is responsible for that attack.
We're speaking with Trevor Paglen, who is an artist and who's photographed and written about drones and military black sites and satellites. And Trevor, in your artistic work, how do you bring these modern-day horrors to the consciousness of the public?
Well, I think my job in the world is as somebody who makes images. And what I want out of art, you know, art is a big thing. Art is many, many different kinds of things, from people doing crafts to cave paintings to Renaissance paintings to somebody like me. What I specifically am interested in art is things that help us see the historical moment that we're living in. I don't mean that metaphorically. I mean that quite literally. How do we learn how to see the world that we live in? And I think that's much harder to do than it might sound like. That's basically what I do, is I try to learn how to read the landscapes that are all around us all of the time and make images that hopefully allow other people to see these landscapes on one hand, but also to give you permission to think about them. And finally, to try to develop a visual vocabulary with which to understand, you know, the world that we live in and the historical moment that we live in. We don't only organize our thoughts with language. We use, you know, all kinds of media with which to generate metaphors that we use to make sense of the world. And I think part of my job as an artist is to help generate those metaphors.
Trevor, speaking of permission, how did you get permission to photograph NSA buildings and equipment?
Mm-hmm. So in some cases, I didn't get permission. So for example, if I go and photograph a landing site, that's some place. You know, a lot of these things are blend almost seamlessly into the landscapes around them, and they're not really, I mean, they can be high security places in some cases, but you don't need permission to. You can go and take a photograph of whatever you want from public land, and that's a long, you know, that's almost a fundamental right. In many countries, that actually is a fundamental right. There's other images that I made where recently, a few months after the Snowden revelations started coming out, one thing that I noticed was that there was a huge amount of reporting being done on very technical programs that were describing, again, this world of mass surveillance, but there was very few images that would correspond to that. And time after time, you know, there was tens of thousands of stories being written around the world and distributed around the world, and I realized that they were all typically using a single photograph of the NSA building of their headquarters in Fort Meade. And I knew that photograph from before, and I knew that that's a public domain photograph that the NSA released. It must have been in the early to mid-1970s, and you can tell because if you get the high-resolution image of it, and then you can go and look at the parking lot, and you can look at the models of the cars that are in there, and they're cars from the 1970s. So I thought, well, how is it that we're learning so much about this agency, and yet, like, literally the only photograph of this agency that's being used in a widespread way is this single image from the 1970s? And I thought, well, at least we should have a new image of the NSA's headquarters. And I knew that that image was taken with a helicopter, and so what I did was actually teamed up with an organization that funds some art projects called Creative Time Reports, and I said, well, hey, why don't you guys work with me? We'll try to get permission to fly over the NSA and other intelligence agencies in a helicopter, and we'll photograph them, and then we'll renounce all the copyrights. We'll just say these images are public domain. Anybody can use them for whatever they want. And we'll try to update this visual language that we have for the NSA.
That's amazing.
To give credit where credit is due, the NSA was very helpful with this, actually. The NSA's PR people basically said, you know, if you'd asked us to do this a year ago, there would be no way in hell that this would have ever happened. But we realize we're in the news right now, and we think that it's a bad time to be saying no to people who want to do this kind of thing. So they actually cooperated with us, gave us the permissions to fly over the building and that sort of thing. We had to hire a guy from the Secret Service to sit in the helicopter with us. So there was quite a lot of paperwork involved, but at the end of the day, they were willing to play ball, which was, you know, very, very good of them.
Well, Trevor, if people want to see these images, is there somewhere we can go on the internet to check out your art?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the images that I talked about specifically just now were released with the launch of The Intercept online. So they did a big story about drones, and then they also, you know, we released these images through the Intercept. And I think we had several million downloads the first day of them. And you see them pop up all over the place. Most of the time, they're not attributed to me, which is sort of the point. I just made them public domain. But you can, if people are interested in other art that I'm doing, I have a website, which is paglin.com.
Spell that for us,
but
please.
If people Google around, there's a lot of stuff out there.
paglen.com, paglin.com. How would you describe the nature of surveillance on all of us today in the United States? Are we approaching a police state surveillance situation? Are we in it? What's the extent of it? What's your understanding of that?
I think that we are living in a total surveillance society, basically. And that might sound hyperbolic, but it really isn't. And I mean that in two ways. On one hand, we can look at the state sector. We can look at, you know, agencies like NSA, for example, who, you know, are tapping every cable and every phone and every email and every router and every embassy, and, you know, the list goes on and on and on to a jaw-dropping degree. On the other hand, we have companies like the Facebooks and the Googles of the world and other companies that are data brokers, whose names you haven't even heard of, who are collecting the most intimate portraits imaginable of us. I think my Google history probably reveals much more about me than, you know, my girlfriend knows about me. And these are in private hands. And today, that information is being used to sell me advertisements to try to get me to buy Crocs or something like that online. But that's not what it's going to be used for tomorrow. Tomorrow, that information is going to be used to probably modulate my credit score, you know, modulate my insurance rates. You know, if I'm drinking a beer in a photograph on Facebook, is my car insurance premium going to go up that month? Probably yes. And Facebook is actually already working on this. They have a patent to do exactly this sort of thing. You add that up, and you can imagine all kinds of other devices. You wear a wristband that counts how far you walk every day, whether you go to a gym or not. One can imagine one's health insurance rates fluctuating based on your exercise patterns and how sedentary or not you might be. I think all of this adds up into a society that is considerably less free than even the society that we live in right now. It's going to be a society that encourages extreme conformity. And when you have extreme conformity, I actually don't think that you can have a democracy. A democracy relies on a plurality of people with a plurality of opinions. That's the whole point of it. And when you don't have that, when you don't have the ability to explore intellectually or aesthetically or culturally without the fear of repercussions for doing that, you have a considerably less free society.
Trevor, recently we interviewed the director of a group called the Library Freedom Project here in the U.S., and they're installing Tor in certain libraries across the country to protect library patrons from government surveillance. What complaints have you heard from the NSA about Tor?
Well, I haven't heard directly anything about Tor, and the woman you're talking about is Allison Macrina, who's
yes.
great, and that's a fantastic project. And I actually have a similar, that's sort of a sister project to her. I have a project with a guy named Jacob Applebaum, who's a computer security researcher and civil libertarian, and we are actually installing Tor relays in museums. So we're doing sort of for museums what Allison is doing for libraries, again, trying to make little bubbles of places that are very, very difficult to surveil, that allow people to use the internet in a much more free way without having to worry about being tracked. We actually just installed one in the northern city of Oldenburg, which is a municipal museum there, and we're basically allowing anybody around the world to use that city's IP address to anonymize their traffic. So I think that is a remarkable project. And I think that thinking about these kinds of infrastructures, thinking about how can we design infrastructures in such a way to enhance freedom, enhance liberty, to enhance democracy itself, I think that we can. I think they're very difficult to fund, and certainly this is not something that the NSA on one hand is particularly interested in, or any of the Googles and the Facebooks of the world on the other. But it certainly is possible.
What would you advise people who are concerned, as we all are, about this? What would you advise them to do?
Well, I think it's very difficult because I don't think that this is a problem that scales down to the individual very well. In the sense that we are all individually victims of mass surveillance, it affects us equally. You know, it affects all of us, but it's not something that I think any individual person can do something about. However, there are a couple of things. First is to educate oneself about it. Second is to probably start using privacy-enhancing tools, you know, in one's everyday life. So, for example, Tor. You know, I use Google, but I also use Tor. And if I'm going to research something like, or if I have some medical condition that I'm concerned about or something like that, I'm going to research that on Tor because I don't necessarily need Google or Facebook knowing that about me. And so kind of there's some everyday things like that that you can do. You can download the Tor browser. You can pull it down. It's a version of Firefox. It'll feel very familiar to just any other kind of internet browser. On your cell phone, you can install an application called Signal on the Macintosh, which does secure text messaging and secure phone calls. On Android, the sister application is called TextSecure, and another application called RedPhone. So there's these kinds of technologies that you can use for kind of some basic self-defense. But I think on the wider level, I think people have to think through a little bit what kind of future this world of mass surveillance looks like, whether we want to have that kind of future or not. And I think that we have to, in general, not make decisions based on fear. We have to understand that public safety is not just about violence, but public safety is also about the safety of our democracy. And the safety of our democracy can be deeply threatened by things like national security agencies installing spyware all over the internet and weaponizing it and doing it in secret. And so I think that we should expand our definition of sacred safety to something about the safety of the kind of society we want to live in as well.
Trevor, we're coming down to the end in terms of running out of time. Before we let you go, we wanted to ask you if there's any final thoughts that you have for us.
I think that's basically it. I would just loop back around to the first thing that you wanted to talk about, which is about this politics of fear. And one of the things that I think about is, you know, us here in 2015, particularly as Americans, we are the safest human beings who have ever existed on the entire history of, you know, human life on planet Earth. We really don't have a lot to be afraid of. And I think that we should, you know, consider that and try to not be swayed by the politics of fear. And we should be very distrustful of people who try to accrue power for themselves by deploying fear as a means to do that.
Well, Trevor Paglen, it's really been an honor for us to have you on the program. We're in total solidarity with you. We applaud your good work. We thank you, and we look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thank you guys so much. It's great to be on your show.
Thanks, Trevor. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
I leave it to the people to suggest what it is, what it is in a digital contest. Boy, boy.
Natasha Bonin is the president of the National Lawyers Guild, as well as a human rights attorney and associate counsel at Latino Justice Pearl Def. At that national civil rights organization, she works with low-wage Latina immigrant workers and on the domestic implementation of human rights norms. Previously, she worked in the International Women's Human Rights Clinic at CUNY School of Law and at the Center for Reproductive Rights. While attending CUNY, she was editor-in-chief of the CUNY Law Review and a fellow at the Center for Latino and Latina Rights and Equality. Natasha has advocated before international and regional human rights bodies on issues including colonialism, sexual violence in armed conflict, reproductive rights violations, and hate crimes. She has written several articles and reports specifically on gender and human rights. Natasha also co-chairs the National Lawyers Guild Subcommittee on Puerto Rico. Natasha, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you both.
We wanted to start by giving you a heartfelt congratulations on just becoming president of the National Lawyers Guild.
Thank you.
And for our listeners who aren't familiar with the Guild, can you give us a brief overview and then talk about why the Guild is important to you and how you first got involved?
Sure, I'd love to. So the National Lawyers Guild, as you both are familiar with, is the oldest and most progressive bar association in the country. It was established 78 years ago as the first integrated bar association, established in part because at that time the American Bar Association would not allow African American lawyers to join the ranks of its membership. The Guild was also created as a way for lawyers to get involved with, at that time, what was really the New Deal projects, the social projects that were being put forth by the administration at that time. And the mission of the Guild is to promote human rights above property interests. And that's because the law, the structure of the law in our legal system in this country is really about preserving wealth, power, and privilege, and those property interests as they're embodied in our Constitution and the jurisprudence. And the guilds and those that join the profession as lawyers, but also as legal workers and law students striving to be lawyers, is interested in the actual justice component of the justice system and what does it mean to have a justice system that prioritizes the well-being of its citizenry in the form of civil and human rights above the economic interest of a few.
You know, given that framework of the Guild, what kind of work were you doing that got you involved in the Guild?
I became familiar with the National Lawyers Guild when I was a student in law school. I went to the City University of New York School of Law, otherwise known as CUNY, which is a progressive legal institution. And the Guild is actually present in over 100 law schools and campuses across the country. And I became familiar with the work, primarily the nature of the Guild's mass defense work and doing work protecting the right to protest and doing legal observing at protests and rallies and marches. And it was work that was inspiring to me, but it wasn't necessarily the work that I was interested in. I actually joined the Guild through a slightly less traditional means, which is through the work of its international committee. And I've done a lot of solidarity work in the Latin American region, including Puerto Rico and Cuba and Venezuela, and was really interested with the solidarity work that the Guild's International Committee, in particular the committee that does work in the Latin American region, and became involved as a student member through that work. And through that committee's work, learned both about the breadth of that committee, but as well as the Guild, of the Guild as a whole, and recognized that this was kind of the progressive legal community that I was looking for, where it wasn't just a network of allies and comrades who shared similar beliefs about what our role is as lawyers in working within an often unjust system, but also where there was deep strategic and critical thinking taking place about how to do better advocacy, how to become better lawyers, how to challenge the legal, political, and economic structures that prop unjust policies. And so it became a space for me where I could channel some of my activism and advocacy through, but also my lawyering.
Natasha, you just came back from the annual Guild convention in Oakland, and it's the first time in many years that Michael and I haven't been to a convention. We saw that you had speakers from Black Lives Matter, and a lot of wonderful guest speakers, as well as the usual workshops. What were some of the highlights for you?
The Guild's convention is always a really amazing space where people come and your soul just gets nurtured. And not only because you're surrounded by hundreds of people who are doing deeply inspiring work and that you can connect with, but also because of that strategizing that I just talked about that really gets to take place where you know, being in the same room with your colleagues and comrades, you really get to spend some time trying to tackle some of the very substantive issues that we all work on. And the convention showcases the breadth and the scope of the Guild's work that takes place through our various committees. And one of those areas, which is the work around Black Lives Matter, our keynote for our opening session was Alicia Garza, one of the three co-founders of the Black Lives Matter movement. And she was extremely inspirational. I mean, she had most of the room in tears by the end of her speech. For me, it was one of the most moving moments, as well as a brief tribute by Kojo Bond, Julian Bond's nephew, in deep gratitude for the work of the Guild and in preserving and continuing the legacy that his uncle, civil rights icon, fought for. For me, I was also deeply moved at our Friday luncheon, which has traditionally been known as the Women's Luncheon, where there were two local artists from the Bay Area, including a Palestinian poet, as well as this singer who had this amazing, deep, deep kind of gospel voice to her, who spoke about and sang about, actually, about the links between Gaza and the Black Lives Matter movement. And so to be able to use these kind of creative, artistic art forms to also discuss the really heavy issues that we were just talking about at the convention, for me was extremely moving and inspiring. And of course, our awards and our awardees. In particular, we had the first secretary for the Cuban embassy join us at the convention and speak about the nature of these historic reopening of relations between Cuba and the United States this year, the new embassy in Washington. Our Evans and Vincent Amos Award went to the chair of our Cuba subcommittee, who spoke about the Guild's decades-long solidarity work in Cuba, both on behalf of the Cuban Revolution as well as the freedom of the Cuban Five, who we know are now back home in Cuba.
We're talking about Art Heitzer, aren't we?
Art Heitzer, exactly, yeah, from yeah. Madison, Wisconsin.
You know, I read yesterday in the paper that the United Nations voted 191-2 to end the blockade. The only votes against were from the United States and Israel.
As usual.
But, you know, but I thought it was important because people think that now with this new relationship between Cuba and the United States that the blockade has ended and that everything's back to normal. Mm. And quite obviously it's not. And
That's right.
I'm so pleased that the Guild was able to, you know, make that point at its convention.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because we actually approved a resolution at the convention to that point, all the ways in which the United States continues to undermine regional interests. And that despite the seemingly positive advances by the Obama administration in wanting to reopen and reestablish diplomatic relations towards a path of normalization with Cuba, that they're actually continuing to undermine that by, for example, refusing to grant visas to Cuban academics and scholars to attend conventions and convenings and gatherings in the U.S. It happens with our convention every year where our Cuban guest lawyers either have their visa granted at the very last minute, as happened this year, the day before the convention, or the visas get granted after the gatherings take place. We also have seen how businesses who have been initiating relations in Cuba have gotten very, very severe fines for doing so, which kind of flies in the face of this stated policy of wanting to open trade doors again with Cuba. And so there's a lot of work, and this is all because of the blockade. There's a lot of work left to be done. And it was great to see the Guild's solidarity work with Cuba be on display this year.
Natasha, as president, what is your vision for the next 3 years for the Guild?
You know, I have so many things that I'd like to see the Guild either continue to be involved in or evolve to. I think that our role is multiple on many fronts. There's the role within the profession. The role that we play is as the conscience of the bar within the profession to elevate the profession to a higher moral standard and to make sure that we help the profession reflect the demographics and realities of this country. And for me, that includes both continuing to push jurisprudence in a number of areas to be more in line with the United States human rights obligations, but it also means, for me, making sure that our membership and our organization reflects the communities that we serve and advocate on behalf of, particularly communities of color, communities that have been historically marginalized and discriminated against, and that those voices become heard and predominant within the Guild. The issues that we work on primarily affect poor communities, communities of color, communities that have been marginalized, targeted, exploited. And so I'm really interested in looking at how we make sure that we show up more fully within those communities and making and that they have a voice. I also think that this is a very, for lack of a better word, interesting time on many fronts.
It's like the Chinese curse. You should live in interesting times. curse times. I totally agree with you. But why do you say that?
I say that for a couple of things. One, I think the nature of how we organize and our activism is shifting. I mean, social media plays a role in that, but also that there's an increased state presence, whether that's through tracking, monitoring, spying, you know, warrantless wiretapping. You know, I mentioned this in my opening talk that I think that the Guild's work kind of in the 40s and 50s against McCarthyism and the Red Scare is preparing us for what we're dealing with today. And I've seen how it's impacted activist work. And so I think the Guild has a very important role to play beyond our traditional kind of the mass defense model work and looking at how we challenge state surveillance of communities and of movements. And so I'm interested in exploring that a little bit more and looking into that. You know, I have a number of things that I'd like to do. Some are also just internal, but I also think that there's an increasing internationalization of our work. And part of that is because of this effort to this kind of bringing human rights home effort at how, when we think about the evisceration of traditional civil rights protections and the decreasing availability of forums, whether they're judicial or otherwise, for us to be able to seek redress and to assert our rights domestically, how we look either to international spaces or to trying to codify international norms and standards within our domestic jurisprudence, you know, that's really resonated, particularly with movements and with community-based groups that find the language of human rights very affirming. And so I've seen kind of this increasing use and interest and mobility around how we redefine our work so that it's more in accordance with that framework. And so I'm interested in making sure that the Guild is one of the leading voices in that effort.
Natasha, on Law and Disorder, we've spoken frequently with your colleagues, Judith Birkin and Linda Bakiel. Tell us briefly about your work in the Guild and elsewhere related to Puerto Rico and Latin America, politically,
sure.
Especially vis-a-vis political prisoners.
So I'm glad you mentioned Judith and Linda, they are some of my icons. Judith and I, along with Jan Sussler, co-chair the subcommittee on Puerto Rico for the Guild, Jan Sussler being a longtime lawyer of many Puerto Rican political prisoners, including Oscar Lopez Rivera, who remains in jail now for 34 years. So my work around Puerto Rico is, as all of ours, as Linda's and Judith's and Jan's, is at the heart is really challenging the colonial relationship that Puerto Rico has with the United States, Puerto Rico being a colony now for 117 years of the United States. And so much of what we discuss related to Puerto Rico really stems from that. And I think it's important to always contextualize the conversation within the realities of what it is to be a colony of one of the world's economic and military superpowers. Many people are aware that Puerto Rico is currently going through an economic crisis and that there have been a number of proposed solutions put forth as a result of that crisis. You know, some of those including modifying the bankruptcy law so that Puerto Rico can access bankruptcy protections the same way, for example, Detroit has and Philadelphia is considering, restructuring the debt. The debt is held in overwhelmingly large part by a number of hedge funds and private investors who engage in very risky bets with municipal bonds on Puerto Rico. As a result, the island is about $72 billion in debt, and the governor has said that that's basically an unpayable debt. You know, and there's an effort to reach out to Congress on a number and the administration on a number of those proposals, and they're interesting proposals. I think particularly the notion of having creditors be forced to restructure their debt and be forced to admit that they engaged in risky financial transactions has its value. But I also think that by doing that, it really misses the larger picture that these are not going to fix Puerto Rico's situation, which at its heart is requires a political solution. You know, they're looking at piecemeal economic solutions, but a political solution is what's required if Puerto Rico is really able to, in order for Puerto Rico to be able to have an economy that can sustain its population and could sustain trade and can sustain its economic needs, that requires sovereignty, that requires the ability of the government to be able to decide what its economic interests are, not the economic interests of the United States, what its economic interests are, and what's the best way that it can go about carrying out those economic interests, the ability to engage in trade with regional partners, with other countries, to be able to decide what its investment should look like, what sector should be invested in, what its production should look like. You know, Puerto Rico currently has to import 90% of its food from the United States, from ships that have to be flagged by the United States under this
Jones
over
Act,
100-year-old, right, the Jones Act, the cabotage law, you know, over 100 years old act. And they pay $550 million extra a year just to have U.S. flagships.
No, I was amazed when I went there the first time how expensive things were in Puerto Rico. But I wanted to get back to your talking about the necessity for Puerto Rico to be an independent country and relate that to the struggle of Oscar Lopez Rivera, because I'm so heartened that you're going to make that central to the Guild's activity. And I wanted you to talk a bit about who Oscar is and what he stands for and what people can do to support him.
Yeah, so Oscar Lopez Rivera is the longest-held Puerto Rican political prisoner. This is his 34th year in jail, and he is unjustly incarcerated, as all former Puerto Rican political prisoners have been, for believing in and fighting for the independence and freedom of his homeland, Puerto Rico, for challenging the colonial relationship that the United States has with Puerto Rico, and for believing in that every nation, as every human being, has the right to be sovereign and free. The Oscar is represented by a National Lawyers Guild lawyer, Jan Sussler, and I am also, in addition to my kind of responsibilities with the Guild, I'm also one of the organizers for the New York City group called 34 Women in New York City for Ohgad, and we hold monthly rallies for 34 minutes, 34 women for 34 minutes to demand the release of Ohgad, representing obviously the 34 years that he's been unjustly incarcerated. I have the tremendous honor in the next few weeks of being able to go for the first time to meet Ohgad. And, you know, what Ohgad has meant to me, to us, to this work is an unwavering commitment in his beliefs for the independence of Puerto Rico, the dignity and integrity that he has maintained and that he has held and that he has shown us of how freedom work happens and can be done, has earned him the recognition of being called the Nelson Mandela of Latin America, and not by me, but by presidents of Latin America who recognize his tremendous sacrifice and his example of what it means to be a freedom fighter. And particularly in a time where, because of the economic crisis, people are fleeing the island. There's a lot of sentiment of blame and blaming Puerto Ricans for their situation, where Ohgad has always been very clear about the roots, the political roots of the economic crisis and the kind of resistance that needs to happen to challenge both the crisis and the colonial status of Puerto Rico.
Oh, Natasha, that's so exciting that you'll be meeting him and we'll be thinking of you during that visit. I understand the Guild's next convention is going to be this summer in New York.
It is. I'm extremely excited about that.
Well, we'll have to have you on before then so we can hear who's going to be speaking and find out what the latest programs are. But it's been truly an honor to have you on.
I don't want to let you go yet.
Okay.
Before you give us the website so we can get further information on the Oscar Lopez Rivera defense and also how people can get a hold of the National Lawyers Guild.
Yes. So for those who are interested in supporting the campaign to free Oscar Lopez, please visit the National Boricua Human Rights Network's website. That's National Boricua Human Rights Network. There's also an online petition asking President Obama to use his presidential power of pardon to grant clemency to Oscar. And we need to reach 100,000 signatures. So all are invited to visit the website and sign the petition and to share it. And for those who are interested in the work of the National Lawyers Guild in getting involved or requesting even a legal observer, you can visit nlg.org.
Well, Natasha, once again, congratulations on being the president of the Guild and for joining us and being so generous with your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's been our pleasure, and we hope to have you on again. Thank you so much, Natasha.
Absolutely. Take care.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
shout and pray when he comes. I'm gonna sing and shout and pray. I'm gonna sing and shout and pray. I'm gonna sing and shout and pray when he comes. I'm gonna sing in every choir. I'm gonna sing in every choir. I'm gonna sing in every choir when he comes. I'm gonna sing in every choir. I'm gonna sing in every choir. I'm gonna sing in every choir.